first where they dumped her, that
I was hoping maybe people would
we got a split. Good talking.
That was more than 5 minutes.
The three committees will reconvene now, and we will move on to the topic of drones. There's been a lot of national attention, a lot of local attention to the question. We're fortunate to have some of the smartest people in this area in Minnesota as well, and I look forward to learning more about what they have to say about the potential for regulation, the need for regulation, the risks, the benefits, issues relating to privacy, security, safety, a lot of issues floating around the question of the use of drones. I know there have been others that have been much more active in this particular subject area than I have, may be further up to speed on this than I am. But it's important to have this public discussion as we go into session to consider what steps, if any, the legislature should take in this area. So we've got quite a few people scheduled to testify, and I think what we'll do is for those of you on the committees that have questions, I want you to feel free to ask questions that are specifically aimed at the topic of the testifier at the time. We will reserve an opportunity at the end of the hearing to have more general discussion among members of the committee if there's anyone who wants to engage in that. So we'll get started here. Representative Les, you've been pretty involved in the drone area in the past. Did you want to say anything before we get started?
Just previously, in a number of hearings we've had on this, it has aroused interest among different fields. And in several of the past hearings, members have come forward with an opinion on things about drones in light of speculated use or anticipated use, or we might use drones someday, therefore this is how we think you should regulate. I mean, I can tell you that I, for myself, and I know there are several members of the committee who are much more interested in those who are using them or have a policy on them on the books already, because that's definitely much more relevant to whatever regulation we may pass here in this body. But that's all I wanted to say, Senator Latz, and I'm interested in getting going.
All right, thank you. Our first testifier is Jeffrey Diebel from House Counsel and Research. Give us some background on state and federal law. Welcome to the committees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I was asked to speak for a few minutes about the general background on drone laws and legislation in Minnesota. So I see my role as setting the table for the smartest people in the state. I'll do my best to set that. There's a packet in your folder with my PowerPoint presentation, as well as summaries of the legislation that was considered last year in the House for your reference. If we go through this, it may be of use. I thought I would begin by just with an idea of the landscape for which drones are being used domestically. They include law enforcement, search and rescue, disaster response, border patrol, land surveillance.
Mr. Diebel, would you pull the mic closer to you for the recording?
Land surveillance, wildlife tracking, and photography. So the use of the nets, just to name a few of the domestic uses. You can see they range from the public safety all the way down to the personal use of exploration of nature. The law enforcement capabilities for drones currently, which is the primary focus for my position as a public safety analyst, include some of the features that are available or should be available, include high-powered cameras, thermal imaging devices,
license plate readers, laser readers, facial recognition technology. So these are all devices that could be deployed on a drone, excuse me.
Or some, on a droid, I suppose.
Or a droid. Could be. Some of the issues that legislators and policymakers need to consider are listed on my fourth slide, and consider the benefits such as product delivery, crop dusting, filmmaking, aerial photography, pipeline and platform inspection for oil, as well as fire detection, traffic control capabilities, and weather forecasting. And these are balanced against some of the privacy concerns that we've all read about, including the freedom from government intrusion into your private affairs, as well as the maintenance of data collected by drones by government entities, as well as simply as snooping neighbors interested in your affairs. Other policy considerations for policymakers include air safety, as whether these drones would interfere with manned aircraft. And then there's quite a bit of discussion about the economic impact of drones, both from the manufacturing side of things as well as the operations, and then the additional ancillary benefits to industries such as agriculture and natural resource exploration and real estate, and to name just a few that can benefit from drone use. According to NCSL, 20 states have enacted laws addressing drone issues. I've listed on the slide provided just some of the general areas that these laws touch on, and they obviously define the term drone, or more commonly they use the phrase unmanned aerial vehicle or unmanned aerial system, UAV. A common theme in these laws is regulating law enforcement's use of drones. That's of a particular concern to both legislators and citizens, and I'll touch on that a little bit further as we go along. There's also some laws that touch on the regulate the general use of drones by the public and protecting each other from, as I said, snooping neighbors. And then the more recreational uses of drones, there's quite a bit of discussion when you get into whether they are how and they should be regulated in the use of hunting and other outdoor activities. A couple of our neighboring states have laws on the books on the issue. In Iowa, their law prohibits the use of drones for traffic enforcement, and perhaps more importantly, it prevents the admission of evidence collected by a drone unless there was a search warrant obtained to secure that information. In Wisconsin, the law requires a search warrant by police to use a drone to conduct surveillance on a person where the subject has a reasonable expectation of privacy. And similarly, they have a law that prevents private citizens from using drones to observe an area or a person in an area where they should have a reasonable expectation of privacy. As I mentioned, there were three bills introduced in the last legislature, I guess the current legislature, to address drone issues. And there are summaries of those of the House versions of those bills in your packet. I'll talk about each one individually. I'll begin with a discussion of Representative Johnson's House File 1994. The brief summary of that is it addresses solely law enforcement use of drones and establishes a general prohibition on the use of drones by law enforcement to gather evidence or other information on individuals. There are a few key exceptions to this general prohibition, including to counter a verified high risk of a terrorist attack, or if you have a search warrant, or if there's an imminent threat to public safety. Those are common themes even in the other states as well, or where they do have a search warrant requirement. The second bill that was introduced in this current legislature was authored by Representative Kahn, and that's House File 1620. This bill addresses both the civilian as well as the law enforcement use of drones. The bill establishes a felony penalty for a person who uses a drone to capture images of persons or things without their permission. And it also prohibits law enforcement agencies from using drones to gather evidence or information in an investigation. Like the Johnson bill, the Kahn bill has exceptions to the law enforcement prohibition based on search warrants, imminent risks to public safety, and likewise. The final bill I'll discuss is Representative Lesch's House File 2552. Representative Lesch's bill addresses law enforcement's use of drones. It's the most comprehensive of the three bills that were introduced as far as regulating law enforcement's use of drones. Generally, the bill requires government entities to secure a search warrant prior to using a drone. The exceptions to the search warrant requirement in the Lesch bill include for emergency situations involving threats to human life and safety. But that exception requires you to, if you invoke that exception to deploy a drone, you still need to come back and file an affidavit with the court explaining why you exercise that authority. And so that's a check on the use of that exception. The second exception to the search warrant requirement is to conduct surveillance on public areas where suspected criminal activity is taking place. But again, you must receive prior authorization from a court of law before you're allowed to do that. Not a search warrant, because you're not going into someone's home, but if you're viewing a public area and you're going to record suspected criminal activity, you do need prior authorization from a court under the Lesch bill. The bill places the following additional limits on drone use by law enforcement. One, the use of the drones must be fully compliant with FAA requirements. Further, the drone purchases must be approved by the governmental entity's legislative body. So a law enforcement agency cannot unilaterally purchase a drone without having prior approval from their legislative authority or legislative body. Also, the use of drones is limited to data collection on clearly and narrowly defined targets, so to avoid just a general data collection. Also, there's a prohibition on the use of facial recognition technology or related options without a court order granting the permission to use that. And finally, the Lesch legislation prevents the deployment of weapons on drones. The Lesch bill also contains several protections, due process protections. First of all, it requires post-surveillance notice to subjects of drone search warrants. So even if a law enforcement secures a search warrant and it's granted, the Lesch bill would require the law enforcement to notify the person after the investigation search warrant was executed and the information was collected. Further protection is that the data collected would be given heightened protection under our data privacy laws to avoid its dissemination beyond the criminal justice needs. The further protection is the public reporting of government entities' use of the drones. So if you own a drone and you use it as a government entity, you need to disclose that to the public, how often you use it. Also, further protection is that the evidence obtained through drones is excluded if you were not authorized to use it under one of the exceptions or you didn't have a search warrant. And then finally, the Lesch bill establishes a civil action for violations if you feel like your rights were violated or that the statute was not followed by a government entity in deploying a drone. There is a civil cause of action created in the Lesch legislation. Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. DeBrother. Questions from members of the committees? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Diebel a question, if he can answer it, if you could maybe send a letter out to get the information. But Mr. Diebel, my question is what current limitations do we have on the PCA, the DNR, County Environmental Services, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Army Corps of Engineers? Now, I think currently some of them are able to, this like county environmental services, they use satellite imagery and photos, and they see an uncompliant well or a boathouse that's built too close to the shore. Or in my county, you have to have, if they see a permit or a building going up and you haven't got a permit, it automatically triggers a sewer system check, and they come out to your farm. There's also imagery that's used if there was one farmer that dug a certain amount of dirt and put it somewhere else on his farm, and you had to get a miner's permit, and they came onto the farm. My question is, do you know if all these state and federal agencies have to have a warrant to use imagery? And the reason I relate that is, if we do anything with drones, I'd love to see something done with the other agencies on these satellite photos, because that's the same thing. They're using them without a warrant, if they are. So I wonder if you had any knowledge about how this would work, if you can take a photo, see something gone wrong, and without a search warrant.
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, would they be using drones for this purpose, or satellite imagery, or manned aerial images?
Well, the satellite, Mr. Chair and Mr. Diebel, the correlation I'm trying to make is, what would be different about using something up in the sky, taking a picture with or without a warrant? How are they able to do it, and do they operate under a warrant system, the current state agencies that in?
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I don't believe they do. There are experts from the FAA here, as well as the ACLU, who I know have looked at more of the regulatory side of it, from the federal side, obviously, and then the litigation side. And this is going to be a hotly litigated issue because of the nature of the technology and how you compare it to our current ability to gather information. And trying distinctions, those who are in favor of broad drone use will argue, perhaps like you are suggesting, that this is perhaps no different than being able to have a satellite image of it. You're just using a different method to secure the information, whereas others will argue that, no, it's pushing us over the line where it makes it perhaps too personal. Perhaps just because you can see it, it makes it more offensive to some people, but it's going to be a very difficult issue for courts to sort out as to what is and is not legal as you compare it to our current technological capabilities. So I don't have an answer to your specific question, but you are touching on some of the areas that courts are going to struggle with in the coming years.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. And Representative Cornish, I think you hit an important point. At least I know for me and my bills, my concern that I wanted to address is not necessarily the type of technology itself, be it drones or be it satellites, but the information that is available to folks that wasn't before and how we get it. So I think what's available in the rapidly changing nature of satellite technology and real-time visuals is relevant there as well. Any other questions for Representative Diebel on his testimony? I'm sorry, for Mr. Diebel on his testimony. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Donald Chance Mark. Mr. Mark, please take a seat, identify yourself for the record, and begin your testimony.
My name is Donald Chance Mark, Jr. I'm an attorney in Minnesota. I practiced for 41 years. I have a law firm, and we have specialized in aviation matters during that time frame. And this past summer, my firm has initiated a subgroup dealing specifically with the issue of drones or UAVs or UASs. I have been asked to appear here today and address a half dozen different topics. I'll do so. I'll touch on each one briefly because of the constraints of time, and then I'd be happy to answer any particular questions. But I will say at the outset, congratulations to this joint committee for doing this, because the things that I'm seeing on the civil side of the usage of this technology requires action. And I think it requires it sooner rather than later. I know that the FAA is working hard but also struggling with all of these various issues, and I think that your taking this on is a very good thing for the citizens of Minnesota. Mr. Diebel talked just briefly, and I will do the same with respect to the various usages, agriculture, real estate, law enforcement, research. There are any number of usages usages of this technology that you can think of. And the only limitation, I think, is the creativity of man. There's a fairly famous commercial that demonstrates the usage of delivering beer to ice fishing houses. I have had the occasion to speak publicly to some organizations, and I have said it's a wonderful piece of marketing, and it is absolutely, completely illegal at the present time. Amazon, of course, has had their famous 60-minute piece delivering packages. The most recent that I've seen that occurred this past week is TGIF Friday's restaurant is now advertising that they will do a moving drone mistletoe within their restaurant. And during the breakout of this, they actually had an accident where they injured the photographer that was recording all of this. So there are any number of things football teams are utilizing for practice purposes, this technology. I've even seen in Europe that there's a mobile defibrillator that is going to be attached to a drone that can make an emergency call if necessary. And, of course, the things that Mr. Diebold talked about in terms of pipeline review, power line inspection, bridge inspection, and the like. There is a significant amount of potential abuse as a result of this technology. And the topics that others will talk about, I'm sure, will be weighing free enterprise versus the privacy issues versus the security issues and versus the safety issues. And one of the things that I've seen is the safety issue with respect to operation by unqualified people in highly populated areas. And I think you're going to be hearing more and more about that. I know there are a number of incidents that I've been made aware of that have not been public, but regretfully, they may be. And, of course, one of the major issues that will be discussed, I'm sure, by the FAA, and I strongly feel the same about, is having this type of technology interact with commercial aviation. I've seen statistics where the FAA is apparently receiving something like 25 reports a month of this type of technology being in a TCA or a terminal control area or even at altitude and reported by commercial pilots as being there. The concerns about the catastrophe that that might cause is significant, not only in terms of property damage. A 737 engine right now probably goes for something between $1 to $2 million, and if it ingested this type of technology, that would be fairly expensive. But even more importantly is the concern about the damage to human life as well as the aircraft. As Mr. Diebold mentioned, the statistics are that in the past year, approximately 13 states have enacted some form of legislation. I won't talk about that other than to say that some of it has been fairly focused on the criminal side of things and what's admissible and what isn't. I haven't seen any legislation that has been more comprehensive in terms of dealing with both the criminal as well as the civil side of things. Locally, the city of St. Bonifacius in March of 2013 passed an ordinance number 115, where they concluded that they wanted to restrict the use of drones in their airspace. The intended purpose was to protect the privacy of their citizens. They made it a misdemeanor in St. Bonifacius if you operate a drone or a UAV or a UAS in their airspace, subject to up to a $5,000 fine and 1 year in jail. In terms of internationally, frankly, a number of countries are probably farther ahead of us than we are right now. The Japanese have been using drones for primarily agricultural purposes for at least 15 years. There are a number of Japanese manufacturers, including Yamaha, that are very much involved in the development and sale of this type of technology. The Japanese have approached it because so much of their use is agricultural by forming the Japanese Agricultural Aviation Association. And that organization has been utilized to standardize pilot training, see that there is appropriate aircraft registration, and the like. There's also an organization called the European Aviation Safety Agency, and that's charged with essentially the same responsibilities. I am not blaming the FAA for perhaps lagging somewhat behind. The proliferation of this technology in the last 2 years has just been amazing, and I don't think was predicted by anyone. And I think the other issue is that the Japanese and other European countries are much smaller than we are and don't have as many airports to contend with, don't have as many commercial flights to contend with. But it is certainly becoming an issue that we need to now embrace. And again, I applaud you for doing so. The most recent legislation is the Perker case. I have provided a summary to the panel in connection with that. That decision came down on November 18 of this year, and essentially what it did is it overturned a decision by the administrative law judge. And the short version of that is this. The initial complaint by the FAA was that an individual was operating a 5-pound styrofoam UAV over the University of Virginia, and as a result, did so without permission, was doing so for the purpose of taking photographs that was deemed to be a commercial use, which is absolutely forbidden unless you have what's called a COA or Certificate of Authorization or an exemption pursuant to Section 333. This individual had neither of those, was then fined by the FAA $10,000. Case was tried before an administrative law judge. The law judge found that he was not liable. The case was appealed by the to the NTSB, and on November 18, the board overturned the administrative law judge's decision. The key part of that decision is that drones are subject to FAA rules, and the FAA may now regulate UASs and UAVs because they have determined that they are aircraft. And I think that becomes important later, as I'll suggest a couple of things that may be appropriate for this committee to consider. I will tell you that there are a lot of illegal operators out there. I've become aware of them when I confer with my clients who are not operating illegally, but want to know when they can operate and what they have to do to operate legally. I will say that a lot of these illegal operators are real estate personnel, whether they're overflying expensive homes on Lake Minnetonka or looking at commercial property. They're using these for purposes of advertising real estate and selling real estate. Agriculture is another issue. We are an agriculture state, and this technology is being utilized, I think, every single day by a variety of agricultural people in our state. I will tell you that there are a variety of conventions that are held involving agriculture, and there are manufacturers of this technology that show up, and there are people that are there to provide training and sell the technology. And then, of course, the photography industry is also very interested in this, and I think there are a number of usages by commercial photographers that are being employed. It's also come to my attention that there is at least one facility that is providing weekend flight training to operators of drones. And keeping in mind that these are pieces of technology that you can walk into virtually a hobby store and spend $500 and now be in the drone business. This weekend operation gives some flight training and then issues certificates after a weekend saying that they are approved to fly. The question, of course, is whether or not they really are and whether or not they've got the experience and the training to operate these devices safely. I've mentioned the intrusion on commercial airspace, and in my mind, being a major hub in the Midwest, that's a significant issue. And I'm sure the FAA will address that, but as a civil attorney specializing in aviation matters, it causes me great concern. And I'm sure if the Airline Pilots Association were here, they would express the same concern. Let me make a couple of suggestions as you gather your information, but I think there ultimately will be a number of things that you would want to consider as you go forward with your analysis of this topic. Would it be appropriate to, at least for people that are purchasing drones for commercial purposes, to register them at the time they purchase? If so, that would certainly lead to the ability to be able to track the owners and the operators that are utilizing this technology. Would it be appropriate to require that there is appropriate pilot training for the operation, particularly commercially, of these devices? What about creating approved vendors that could give the appropriate training and perhaps create a uniform syllabus so that people that are operating them, particularly in airspace that is overpopulated areas, will do so in a safe fashion? Is it appropriate to consider that a commercial operator has to be licensed before they can operate for a commercial purpose? And if so, is there a basic license, and then would there be perhaps add-on licenses? For example, someone that's operating in nighttime or dusk operations, or someone that wants to operate over a populated area, perhaps there could be added ratings that would come with that. There has also been discussion about limiting the size of the device and limiting the weight, and perhaps certain training required depending upon the size that would be operated. One of the topics that has not been discussed, to my view, but I think should be, certainly by this committee, is the requirement of insurance, particularly for commercial purposes. In Minnesota, we have a strict liability statute. It's Section 360.012, Subdivision 4, that requires the owner or operator of any aircraft that causes any damage on the ground to be strictly liable for that damage. And I think one of the questions would be is whether or not that now applies to this type of device. And that will come to, I think, the definition of what aircraft is. Under Section 360.511, Subdivision 16 in Minnesota statutes, aircraft means any contrivance now known or hereafter invented, used or designed for navigation of or flight in the air. The Perker case cites 49 USC as well as 14 CFR and simply says the drones are an aircraft is any device used in flight in the air. So there's a fair amount of similarity between the two statutes, but what I would commend to this joint panel is to consider whether or not there needs to be any clarification in our statutes to make sure that, one, these devices or contrivances are covered by our strict liability statute, and, two, whether or not they should be insured. I will tell you that the major insurers of aviation matters all have a basic policy now and are insuring, and I think that they will become more savvy as this technology continues to grow. And it may be that the insurance industry itself will be the ones that will require a certain amount of training, licensing, and the like in order to obtain insurance. There has been discussion and some suggestion by the FAA that perhaps to operate for at least commercial purposes, a UAV, a UAS, or a drone, that you would be required to have a private pilot's license. That strikes me as being acceptable from the standpoint of being able to control how the drones are operated. On the other hand, I think it will be very difficult for people that are simply utilizing these for their own personal purposes to be able to afford that expense in time. And it also begs the question of whether or not the holder of a private pilot license has any proficiency whatsoever in terms of operating a UAV or a drone. So I will conclude by saying that I think that this committee ought to consider whether or not you need to do anything definitionally in our statutes, whether or not you need to define the difference between recreational use and commercial use. And, of course, you're going to be hearing, and you have in the summary, in terms of research use, which is different, in terms of law enforcement, which is different. But I think that the task of us as Minnesotans and the task of this joint committee in terms of doing what's best for our state and our citizens is to balance the freedom to use these devices in a safe way without intruding on the rights, the safety, and the privacy of others, and ensuring that commercial operators must meet certain standards to ensure that their safe commercial operations occur.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Mark. Are there questions from members of the committee for Mr. Mark? Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would a farmer using a drone to survey their own land be considered a commercial use that would need to obtain a permit?
Mr. Mark.
Mr. Lesh, Representative, I knew that question was coming because I have asked that same question myself. And what I will say is it's probably better addressed to the FAA, but I've talked to farmers, and the question is, if I have 1,500 acres of my own property, why can't I use that without any other requirements? And I won't address it from the FAA standpoint because they will, I'm certain. But my view would be that's a very tricky question because if you're using it and it's for a commercial purpose, you may be required to have it licensed. There are other issues that the agricultural community has shared with me, and that is if there is an interface of this type of device with typical crop dusters, we'll say, typical aircraft, that's a bad combination as well. And I've had people tell me that typical spraying operations with crop dusting type aircraft, which operate at high speed and low altitude, don't want to have anything to do with somebody operating a drone in that situation. So that's a long way of telling you, I don't know.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you answer a question of whether or not the states have been given authorization by the federal government to write stricter laws regarding these type of devices?
Mr. Mark.
Mr. Lesh, Senator, that was the second question I expected to receive. And I think the answer is more of a constitutional one. But my view is that until the FAA issues its rulemaking, and the United States Congress charged them to have it done by September of 2015, by all indications, it's not going to be done by then. But what the FAA is doing is little by little granting COAs, or certificates of authorization. The most recent is seven different film companies that have received it. Until that happens, I believe that the states do have a right to enact legislation. And to the extent that it might be at odds with subsequent federal law, it will probably have to change. But I also believe that the proliferation of this technology is such that this is an issue that's upon us now. And if the federal government isn't equipped to be able to address it for at least another year or year and a half or however long it takes, and there's a process, a rulemaking process, asking for comment and so forth, then I think it's incumbent upon the states to act sooner.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Is there any difference between a drone that would be carrying a payload versus a drone that would be used for surveillance with camera equipment?
Mr. Mark.
And do we make a differentiation, or does federal government make any differentiation between the two purposes rather than just the drone itself?
Mr. Mark.
Mr. Lesh. Senator, again, that is probably a better question for the FAA, but the federal government has differentiated between the size of drones, typically 5 pounds and utilizing, let's say, a camera, as opposed to something that Amazon is proposing that would be larger and capable of carrying small packages. So I think there is a difference, but and I'm sure you'll hear more of this later, but there is the issue then of the security with respect to a small drone that can carry a high-resolution camera, and we know that that technology is out there now. I don't know that you need to get, if you do embrace these issues with legislation, necessarily to that degree. And I would encourage you to look at sort of the bigger picture in terms of safety, privacy, security, and those kinds of issues. I've been asked in a different forum whether or not there's a concern about weaponry being handled by this type of technology. And we know already from everything we see on the nightly news that certainly there are drones that can carry weapons. As it's currently, however, configured, these types of drones that we're talking about would not be able or capable of carrying that type of weaponry. But I think that's another issue that is going to ultimately have to be addressed.
Thank you. And Senator Hall has a question. But before that, I'd ask members to be mindful of the fact that we have quite a few other testifiers. We are going to, I've spoken with Senator Latz, make a request that subsequent testimony be limited to 10 minutes, with the exception, I know Mr. Stanley has flown in from out of town for this. But when you take a look at the list of testifiers, and you're going to ask a question,
please take into consideration of whether one of those subsequent folks could better answer it. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, for time's sake, I'll pass.
Okay, thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Mark. Just for my own information, a general legal question, and I can find this myself, but what is the legal and constitutional basis for federal regulation of airspace in particular? And then how is federal regulation determined currently? Is it a certain number of feet from the ground? Could you just shed some light on that and then maybe point me in a direction to where I can find the legal basis for a federal regulation of airspace?
Mr. Mark.
Mr. Lesch, Senator, I'll be brief because, again, the FAA will be able to answer this. But essentially, the United States government has control over all the airspace in the United States. The states have control over their individual airspace. But from a national standpoint, flight operations have to be, by conventional aircraft, have to be a minimum of 500 feet above the tallest object on the ground. So if it's a ground, it's 500 feet. If it's the IDS building, it's 1,000, 1,500 feet, whatever it is. Typically, hobbyists were allowed to operate the first type of drone from 400 feet and below. But they could only operate line of sight, and this type of technology, it can be programmed so they can go out of sight and then actually come back. So that was one of the big differences. And one of the things that the FAA quite properly has done, in my view, is also indicated that they cannot be operated within 5 miles of an airport or a TCA or terminal control area. So the federal aviation regulations are the place to look for that, and I'm certain the FAA can further expand upon what I've just said. But I will say that there have been reports of these drones operating at well above 500 feet, and those reports have come from commercial pilots.
Thank you, Mr. Mark. Any other questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, then thank you for your testimony, Mr.
Thank you,
Mark.
Mr. Leach.
We have folks from the FAA up here, Mr. Turner, Mr. Morris, and Mr. Nelson, if you could all take a seat together. Thank you. Who's ever going to start? Go ahead and please introduce yourself for the record. Begin your testimony. Are we signing in? Yeah. Okay. Please sign in if you testify to it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and representatives. First off, let me introduce myself. I'm Robert Turner. I'm the manager in the Flight Standards District Office here in Minneapolis. We deal with all of the safety perspectives in our geographic area, which is basically the state of Minnesota. I've also taken this opportunity to ask two of our aviation safety inspectors, Inspector Nelson and Inspector Morris, to come along. They, in addition to other duties, are our focus POCs for UAS operations. One of the things that's very interesting, as everybody knows, is you have new technology, it certainly provides new challenges. And from an FAA perspective, that's really the challenge for the FAA. How will we be able to get unmanned aircraft systems operating in the national airspace in a safe manner? Again, I will repeat that we are aviation safety inspectors. We're not policymakers, so therefore we may have to take some questions. We are prepared to take your questions and get them to the appropriate level to get answers if we're unable to answer some of those. Also, the intent of our of accepting the invitation here today was certainly to get some educational information and some of our reference material out to the people that we really think will be able to use it as you move forward doing your jobs. The FAA is really responsible, as you've heard, to maintain safety in national airspace. Many times you'll see the acronym NAS. But our two primary concerns with any operations in the national airspace is to maintain safety in that space. We're also very concerned with the UAS operations that we preserve the safety to persons and property on the ground. Some of the things that impact UAS operations and the safety of UAS operations are things such as, are they really where are they operating at? If they're operating in the proximity of an airport, presents a much higher risk for us. If they're operating over populated areas, certainly requires a little higher scrutiny in the fact that they're operating over persons and properties. And we have seen where injuries have occurred from a UAS or drone aircraft. But what's the size and weight of the aircraft, which also impacts considerations and impacts really the level of safety that the FAA will hold them to from a regulatory standpoint? Are they operating in the line of sight? Those type of things. Bottom line for the FAA is, they set the regulation at the appropriate level for the national airspace. And the appropriate level would be, a good example would be our airliners and our air carriers who operate the national airspace in positive airspace operate at the highest level of safety in the public interest, where if you were a private pilot or someone operating a small ultralight, the level of regulation is at the appropriate level then to ensure safety for persons and property on the ground. And let's see. My other point is that UASs are subject to all of the operational rules that we would expect carriers and operators to operate in when they operate in national airspace. And with that, I turn it over to Mr. Morris.
Mr. Morris.
All right. Thank you, Chairman, members. Thanks again for letting us come here to provide some information. To reiterate, my name is Kevin Morris. I'm an aviation safety inspector. I'm with the Minneapolis Flight Standards District Office. And to be mindful of our 10-minute time window, I will be brief on briefing our briefing paper that we gave to you. Essentially, what we have in terms of the FAA perspective on UAS, which is unmanned aircraft systems, you can call them drones, you can call them quadcopters. They all fall underneath the unmanned aircraft system, UAS. We look at them in three categories currently. The first is public aircraft, the second would be civil aircraft, and the final one is model aircraft. Each one of those categories has specific requirements for operational purposes, but the biggest issue in our current FAA policy is that no one may operate an aircraft in the national airspace system without specific authorization. So currently our specific authorization for those three categories of UAS fall underneath public aircraft, which are typically Department of Defense, law enforcement, Customs Border Patrol. Those are authorized under a certificate of authorization. That is a document that's issued and vetted at the national level in Washington, D.C. The second one, which is what we're all probably talking about here today, is civil aircraft, commercial use of civil aircraft. Again, right now, the only way to operate a UAS as a civil aircraft is to go through all the appropriate procedures for airworthiness and pilot certification. That can be done through an exemption process right now, which was mentioned in previous testimony. That's Exemption 333, which is part of Public Law 112-95. And finally, the model aircraft. The modeling aircraft community obviously is doing it as a hobby purpose. And those procedures for operating a UAS as a model aircraft are outlined in Advisory Circular 9157, I believe, is the number on that, which is part of your package, 9157. So that being said, I'm sure we have a lot of questions. I'll be happy to take them. I was elected as the spokesperson for the group in such a way, so I'll take most of your questions. As Mr. Turner indicated, if there are questions that we don't have the answers to, we certainly can run it up the chain and get those answers to you in a timely manner. So
thank you, Mr. Morris. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me then, do you regulate below the 500-foot mark that was previously talked about? So if a civil aircraft is, 30 feet in the air, does that need to be regulated by you, or is it regulated by you?
Mr. Morris?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, that is correct. Aircraft that are operating in the national airspace system, whether it be 10 feet off the ground or 10,000 feet off the ground, are subject to FAA regulations.
Okay. Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Mr. Turner or anyone else at the table, does the FAA ensure or require some type of liability coverage in the event that there's an accident with these machines?
Mr. Morris?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, not to my knowledge, we do not have specific regulations that would require someone to carry insurance for the aircraft, for UAS.
And Mr. Chair, and that's for commercial purposes as well as hobbyist interests?
Mr. Morris?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, currently we do not have any regulations that permit commercial operations of UAS. So the short answer, although it may be incomplete, it would be no, but that's only because we do not permit commercial operations at this time as a wholesale authorization.
Mr. Chair, I can only imagine these things are going to become more popular as hobbyists get involved and other people think that there might be a commercial purpose for them, but I'm somewhat concerned that if there's already a designation of a 5-pound limit in a payload, and if there was a failure of an engine and it falling to the ground, it could hit someone, and a 5-pound piece of anything falling out of the sky from 400, 500 feet is going to create quite a dent and perhaps even kill someone. So I'm a little concerned about the safety of them. We usually don't talk about liability much. We talk about intrusion. We talk about newfangled invention now flying around that may run into another plane. But there certainly could be damage, and certainly a liability issue would be raised over this whole thing.
Any other questions for the testifiers? If not, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming forward.
Mr. Chair, one other question.
Senator Limmer. Thank you, sir.
The term UAS was used. What does that stand for?
Mr. Morris?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer. UAS stands for Unmanned Aircraft System.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Jay Stanley, American Civil Liberties Union. Mr. Stanley, thank you for coming in for this. We know you've come a long way nationally to address us today. We're going to allow you a little bit more time than because of our time restrictions. So in light of that, but please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony. And Mr. Stanley, we may have questions in the midst of your testimony, so I will interrupt you throughout if there are questions from members.
Okay, great. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting us to present our views here today. I am in a role at the ACLU where my job is to look at new technologies that have not been around for a long time and to try and help us figure out what their implications are going to be for our privacy and other civil liberties and what we should be saying about them and advising people and what positions we should take. And drones first came to my attention in the early 2000s. I would get an occasional press call, sort of a science fiction-y thing at that point. But around 2000, they suddenly seemed to become very real, and I co-authored a report on drones calling for a basic regulatory structure for this new technology. Our primary concern when it comes to drones or UAVs or UASs is that they not become yet another avenue for mass routine surveillance of American towns and cities and neighborhoods and streets. The capabilities are there to do that. It's now technologically possible to have an eye in the sky over every American neighborhood. The existing laws that govern this are very weak. And of particular concern is location tracking. We don't want a situation where from the moment that you leave your front door in the morning until you return home at night, your every coming and going is tracked and recorded and lodged in the database. That would give the authorities or whoever has that data the ability to really hit rewind on your life and look back at where you have been. And a location trail like that is a very, very powerful, significant, and intrusive set of information. It could reveal what kinds of establishments you go to, who you are spending your time with, who your friends are, who your lovers are, who your doctors are, what their specialties are, what religious activities, political activities, union activities you engage in. And we and the people we represent don't want to live in a country where that is the new reality. And I think that if we do nothing, there is a chance that we could get there. This threat is it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to happen, if it happens, over coming years and decades. But it's nonetheless a very real threat. We have seen proposals, and law enforcement's use of UAVs today, as law enforcement will tell you, rightly so, is very, very limited, partly because of the FAA rules. We're seeing very small, very noisy aircraft that can only stay up for a very limited period of time under very strict FAA rules. But it doesn't take any imagination to look down the road to see a reality where the technological capabilities are much greater than they are today. We have seen certain law enforcement officials wanting to use this technology in very broad ways. For example, the mayor of Ogden, Utah, tried to put up a aerial vehicle, a blimp, actually, which is one form of UAV, over neighborhoods 24/7, 365, to just watch the entire neighborhood. He was denied permission to do that by the FAA, but the desire was there. We've seen other proposals in other places for similar things. There's a company in Ohio called Persistent Surveillance Systems, which uses gigapixel cameras, super high resolution cameras, puts it on actually a manned aircraft so that all the issues around drone regulation are zeroed out, puts it on a manned like Cessna aircraft, flies over a city for 8-hour shifts, and records an entire 25-square-mile area all at once, stores that information, and it can track where different vehicles and pedestrians anywhere within that area move. And they are pitching that service to police departments around the country and have had trials in Dayton and in Sacramento, I believe, and in Philadelphia. So far, none of the police departments have actually purchased that activity. They've been highly controversial locally. It's new territory for us as a country. Do we want to live in a world where there is a permanent record, aerial record of everything that we do? But that's just to say that the technology is here. That's being put on Cessnas today, but could easily be put on a drone, which would remove much of the expense of hiring a pilot, ground crew, expensive manned aircraft, and so forth. There's also, when we look at this issue, we look at it through the lens of the history of political surveillance that's taken place in this country, going back to the labor movements of the early 20th century, through the civil rights movements, the anti-Vietnam War movement, where we saw a lot of political abuse, the use of police powers, surveillance powers, abused not to maintain peace and to prevent crime and to follow evidence where there was evidence of wrongdoing, but to surveil people because of the particular opinions that they had, peaceful people because of the opinions that they had. We see that happening right up to the present, unfortunately, where we have seen surveillance of people because of their political views. Just in the last week, we've been getting reports from around the country that police are videotaping peaceful protesters protesting the Eric Garner decision, exercising their First Amendment rights on the streets, being surveilled for no reason. We also, unfortunately, have a record of secrecy. When you look at license plate scanners, at stingrays, we have seen a pattern where law enforcement has bypassed bodies such as this, elected officials, and just gone straight to buying the devices, often bypassing local budgetary procedures by getting money from Homeland Security, sometimes donations from hardware manufacturers. And you know, law enforcement often tells me, you know, look, we're going very slowly on drones. We're consulting with the public, and I think that's excellent. That's great. But I think that part of the reason that that's happening is because the FAA has really held back deployment of drones, and by holding back deployment of drones on their safety reasons, has created a space where there's been an enormous discussion that we don't often have with these technologies. So one of the key things is that we have a transparent discussion, and I think it's great that you all are having this informational hearing. And we've seen really an amazing national outpouring of concern on this issue with legislation considered in 42 state legislatures in just 2 years and enacted in 20, legislation of varying kinds. So what we have called for is, when it comes to the police and government use of drones, We've called for some basic common sense rules around how they are used. We would like to see them basically used only where the police have reason to believe that they could be that they will collect evidence of wrongdoing. Our main concern, again, is to stop the suspicionless mass use of this as a surveillance tool. So if the police want to, you know, conduct a dangerous raid on a house where there's suspected criminal activity and they have a warrant and they think that a drone will be useful in carrying out that raid, we have no problem with that whatsoever. We have no problem for its use finding a lost child in the woods or in other emergency situations. I know if it was my daughter, I'd want every tool possibly used in that kind of situation. And we also called for regulations around how the imagery that's collected is handled and used, who it's shared with, how long it's retained. And we've called for, again, public notice and democratic control so that, these issues are very, very sensitive. They go to core questions about what kind of society we want to live in, what the balance of power is between the police and citizens. And these are decisions that should be made democratically and openly and not what I call sometimes policy making through procurement, where the police just buy it and start using it. And so it's important that there be democratic notice and control of drone policies, particular drone policies that police departments may have. We'd also call for auditing so that the public can know whether or not the drones are actually being effective in helping law enforcement improve its operations or whether they're just an expensive, useless toy. That's something that the public should know. And we've also called for, a ban on armed drones, lethal or non-lethal weapons. And I think that there's pretty much a national consensus at this point that armed drones are beyond the pale. The International Association of Chiefs of Police has endorsed that view as opposed to arms drones. And really, I have seen just about nobody except for a Texas sheriff propose the use of armed drones. So some people sometimes say, and the drone industry says, you know, we don't need regulations now. We should wait and see. The legal system, we should let the legal system handle it. We should let the judiciary handle it. The problem is that the legal system isn't really ready for drones, and the legal system, the gears of the legal system of jurisprudence turn very, very slowly. It took the Supreme Court 40 years to apply the Fourth Amendment and warrant requirements to telephone calls. In the 20s, they said, well, the wires leave your home, and so they don't have Fourth Amendment protection. And then in 1968, they decided that the First Amendment protects people, not places, and reversed that. But that took 40 years. And we don't have the luxury in the age of technological revolution to wait that long. And why should we wait for abuses to happen before we act when we know very well that the technology is there to permit it, the desire is there to do it, and checks and balances are necessary. In our system, we have checks and balances on power. We're living in an age of technological revolution where the new technologies are conveying significant new powers. Drones are a very powerful surveillance tool that conveys significant new powers to the authorities and to the government. We want the police to be able to use it, this technology, in good ways to improve their law enforcement, but we also want to put checks and balances to make sure that the appropriate balance is kept between privacy and law enforcement power and to prevent abuse. It's not clear how the Constitution will be interpreted as applying drones. There was a decision called Sorello in the 70s that said basically there was a fellow who was growing marijuana in his fence. The police suspected it, but he had a very tall fence. They couldn't see in, so they flew a plane over. They looked down. They photographed it. He went to court saying they didn't have a warrant. The Supreme Court said you don't need a warrant to take a photograph looking down into private property, because anybody flying an airplane could have looked down and seen that. And there were two other cases sort of reaching the same decision, one involving Dow Chemical and another marijuana case. Now, the Supreme Court in its recent Riley decision about looking at cell phones incident to arrest said that the quantity of information is important to the quality of the decision. And that was a very significant case because the Supreme Court for the first time said there's just so much information on your cell phone compared to what there's in your wallet, and they can search your wallet without instant arrest, that that changes the nature of the First Amendment or of the Fourth Amendment calculus. And that's very significant for drones, too, because it's not clear that the Supreme Court would rule the same way for a drone hovering 24/7 over private property as they would for a Cessna aircraft flying over and taking a snapshot. But we don't know how the Constitution will be interpreted as applying to drones, which is why it makes sense for state legislatures and others to step in and put in place good common sense rules. I think that, when it comes to the private sector or commercial use of drones, we have not proposed any regulation or legislation at this time. And there's a number of reasons for that. We've proposed legislation for the government use of drones and regulation, but not for the commercial use of drones. The first reason, I think, is that the privacy dangers are not as clear. I think, drones is a brand new technology, and we don't always know exactly how it's going to play out. It's not clear exactly what dangers will be real and what won't be. There are certainly privacy issues that are brought up by the use of drones, whether it's private spying, one neighbor spying on another, or persistent surveillance of private property, the use of drones. You could imagine that Google would put drones up over a city 24/7 and have live Google Earth, which I think would make a lot of people uncomfortable. But it's not clear how many of these scenarios will become real, and it's also not clear, less clear, to what extent existing laws will apply. There seem to be more existing laws that would apply to private sector use of drones than to government use of drones, where really there are very few, if any, limits. For example, Peeping Tom laws would pretty clearly, and they vary widely state to state, but they would pretty clearly apply if, for example, you flew a drone up to a third floor bedroom window and pointed a camera inside that window, would pretty clearly violate Peeping Tom laws. And by the way, if law enforcement did that, that would pretty clearly violate the Fourth Amendment. So there are some strictures on law enforcement use. And nuisance laws and trespass laws may also apply in some ways to the private use of drones. And also, there are going to be a lot of really cool uses of drones that could make our lives better. People will think of 1,001 really amazing uses for drones. We've heard some of them discussed today. And, we don't want to inhibit innovation in that area. The ACLU, we are pro-technology. We are pro-innovation. We want to see technology used to make our lives better. We think we can have our cake and eat it, too, if we think carefully about these issues. If we can have our cake and eat it too, we can have our privacy protected, we can have the fundamental nature of our society preserved and our values preserved while still getting the benefits of these technologies if we just think a little bit about this and act. And the other issue for us with drones, the ACLU is a photographer's rights organization. We believe that there are First Amendment rights to photography. We've seen around the country individuals filming public buildings, railroads, and so forth, hassled by security guards and by police officers. We've seen people photographing the police, conducting an arrest, making a stop, what have you, who are not interfering at all with legitimate police operations, but from a distance are videotaping it, being harassed, arrested, or worse by police officers. And we have filed lawsuits around that, and we have won. The courts have been all but unanimous that you do have a right to take photographs in a public place if you are lawfully there. And the question is, how does that apply to drones? And this is a complicating issue for us because we also obviously value privacy very highly. But I think that the presumption should be that if you are somewhere where you are lawfully able to fly a drone, that you as an individual probably have a right to take photographs from that place, subject to possible future privacy regulation. That, again, we think that we should take a little bit more of a wait and see on the private sector regulation. The exception, I think, would be if we see anything that resembles a pretextual use of safety. If we think that the safety rules that are being put in place are not really safety rules, but are an attempt to keep people from using drones, from engaging in photography, we would be highly skeptical of that. In fact, we've already seen that with some of the restrictions on how drones were used in Ferguson during the protests. And that has raised a lot of questions because the FAA put in place flight bans around Ferguson that seemed to be asked by the Ferguson police more motivated out of an attempt to stop people from photographing what was happening rather than true safety concerns. But people have used drones in protests in Europe to photograph how the police are handling riots. They've been used for other by news gatherers. We want, there are a lot of First Amendment issues there, and so we want to hit the right balance between the First Amendment and privacy. So that is one of the reasons why we have taken sort of a wait and see attitude towards drones. And I guess just to finish up, drones are a brand new technology, and they're evolving very quickly. And that makes it very, very difficult for policymakers to address it. We can't predict the complicated ways in which the technology will interact with the other different parts of society, the police, reporters, individuals. And so it's a very, very difficult question to figure out exactly how to regulate it. And the FAA has been struggling with the safety side, and they've come in for a lot of criticism from the drone industry for not supposedly going fast enough in integrating drones into the national airspace. It appears that they're going to miss a congressional deadline of September 2015. We don't have a dog in the safety questions fight. We are not safety experts. We're not aviation experts. It does seem very clear that, as I said, when it comes to the law enforcement surveillance issues, it does make sense. For once, we can get ahead of the technology because of the space that's been created here, the delay by the FAA, and have a good, thorough discussion of the issues and get ahead of the deployment issues rather than waiting for abuses to start happening. And it makes sense to do that in the law enforcement context. And so I think I will stop with that overview. I'd be happy to talk in depth about any particular aspects of this. It's a really complicated issue, and it raises a lot of complicated questions. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Stanley. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Stanley. You briefly touched on, the question I had for you, which was regarding whether or not law enforcement would need a warrant to take aerial images via drone, because we know from the court cases that you mentioned that when law enforcement is flying over to gather images on whether or not you're growing marijuana or if the Department of Natural Resources is taking pictures to see if you're baiting deer, that they are entitled to do that via the court ruling some time ago without a warrant. And so I'm just wondering, are there pending cases in other states where law enforcement are using drones to gather images, and has somebody challenged the constitutionality of that and whether or not it needs a warrant? Because, it seems to me with the current legal precedents we have where law enforcement can take aerial images without a warrant, it seems to me that there's a lot of unknowns on whether or not there would be constitutional protections as far as the Fourth Amendment goes.
Mr. Stanley.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I think that you are right. There is a lot of uncertainty there. Basically, as it now stands, it's a little bit of a Wild West. They're really, under the existing Supreme Court decisions, law enforcement does not need a warrant when using a fixed aircraft to fly over and take a picture. That much is clear, the court had never addressed more sort of sustained surveillance. There's also cases on the use of for example, thermal imaging, where it was found when a police officer looked at a house using thermal imaging and saw heat lamps that indicated a marijuana grow operation. The Supreme Court in that decision, in a decision authored by Scalia, found that you do need a warrant for that. And so if there were any kind of thermal imaging things, then maybe a warrant, the court precedent suggested a warrant would be needed. But otherwise, basically, no, according to the current jurisprudence, a warrant is not needed for drones as far as the courts have ruled, which is one of the reasons why we think it's important that state legislatures act and put in place, which you have the power to do, to require your police to get a warrant in order to do that. Because and people sometimes ask me, what's the big deal about drones? Why is it? Are they really any different from police helicopters? And I go back to what I said about the Riley decision, which is that quantity changes quality. I think that a police helicopter costs $6 million. You have to have a pilot. You have to have shifts. You have to have a ground crew. You have to have maintenance. And the expense of that kind of surveillance has always imposed a sort of built-in limit. There are privacy issues that are raised by helicopters. There was an incident in New York City where a police helicopter that was supposed to be watching a political rally swung its camera over and for an extensive period of time, 20 or 30 minutes, videotaped a couple making love on a darkened, what they thought, pitch-black rooftop balcony using night vision. Parts of the tape were mysteriously missing when they were turned over in a case of a court case, but it was pretty clear that and they interviewed the couple. So it's not as if police helicopters don't raise privacy issues, but they have been, because they're so rarely used and they're so expensive to use, there's a natural inborn limit to how much surveillance you're going to do, and there's natural incentives for police to use them when they really need them and when they really need them only. But when things get really, really cheap and really, really easy, they tend to get overused, and we've seen this in many contexts in privacy. When it becomes really easy to just watch everybody, why not watch everybody, collect everything just in case you need it? The problem with that is that in our values, in our society, we don't allow the government to look over everybody's shoulder and watch everything that you're doing just in case you later turn out to be a criminal. They have to have specific evidence, particularized suspicion of you before they invade your privacy. So I've gone on too long, but that's our view.
Representative Moline, that was some of the testimony we had in the past session, too, that I believe the price tag was $20,000. For a helicopter for a day versus $2,000 for a drone. I'm probably off on that, but that it was suggested that $20,000 served as a substitute warrant requirement because no department's going to spend that amount of money without previously having some idea generally that they know they were going to get, and that was the previous investigation of it. So, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, sir, how do you make up your mind whether you're going to weigh in on a certain scenario? In other words, in Mankato, I'm thinking they had an assault problem in the downtown area by the bars there for a while. It got pretty severe, and so what they did is they peppered cameras all over, and it was in the newspaper about there's a camera almost in every intersection videotaping people to deter crime. Now, how would that work? Did you folks weigh in on that? And other cities have done that now, too, in crime areas, just put cameras all over, so just about anywhere you go, there's a camera on you. I was wondering if you weighed in on that, and do they need a warrant? Is it a difference that the city government buys it and makes available for police so they don't have to get a warrant, or how does that work?
Mr. Stanley?
Mr. Chair, member, thank you. The ACLU is generally opposed to government-run video surveillance of our public spaces. We fear that it lends too much power to the government, is too susceptible to abuse, and that it will create chilling effects. It will change the nature of our public spaces. I think that there is also the case that if something dramatic does happen, increasingly today we're seeing private cameras, and as I said, we're now living in an age when pretty much everybody is carrying a video camera in their pocket. When dramatic things happen, private cameras tend to capture it, which is making the construction of government-run networks of cameras. We're seeing some cities that are building networks of cameras throughout the entire city that are centrally run and centrally observable so that an individual could be tracked everywhere they go from camera to camera. And we think that in the long term it is not a good trend. It's not the direction we should go, especially now that if there is a crime, there's often private cameras that the police can go, and it's distributed. It's not centrally controlled, not susceptible to abuse. I mean, we don't oppose particular cameras in particular places. If there's good reason to think that a certain spot may be the subject of a crime, or for example, at a national monuments, and if there's a crime happening in the same spot repeatedly every day, maybe it would be reasonable for a camera in that situation. Our emphasis is on responding in particular to particular problems and not putting in place blanket surveillance.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, which opens up a real can of worms for our committee because the question I brought up earlier, the DNR catalogs aerial photos of shorelands and you get the reeds and the rushes disappearing year after year, then they go down after that landowner. Or if they see somebody tiling something out in the country without a tiling permit, and it looks like they can do that right now without warrants. And then the these cities that are peppering places with cameras, I'm wondering, are we going to contest just the delivery method or the surveillance method, or is our committee, I wonder, going to get into all of these areas that are using photograph and imagery, not just the drones, and all these state agencies and feds that do it already without warrants? That's going to be an interesting subject for us.
Agreed, Representative Cornish. And I, you know, I'd restate what I said previously, that to me it's not the technology itself. It's what we know about individual citizens' private lives that we didn't have access to before, which is what's most important to me, and how we use it, of course. Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regard to the difference between full-sized manned helicopters and drones, it's not only the cost. There's a qualitative difference as well. I have helicopters over my house all the time because of my proximity to the Army Training Center up there. And you know when you have a full-size manned helicopter over your house. But you do not necessarily, I don't know that I would know from inside the house that I had a tiny little drone out there over my yard. So we, you know, it's not the same thing at all. And so those are the kinds of boundaries between the situations that we need to pay attention to.
Well, the current military drones, you would know too, Representative Urusso, they sound like flying lawnmowers. But you're right, they will get smaller.
I could think it was a lawnmower, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think we're highlighting one of the problems with, and I think Representative Lesch pointed out, really the real issue, at least in my mind, is the degree to which the state is able to collect and individualize data and then make assumptions about that individual's lifestyle and habits, and through the aggregation of data be able to paint a clear picture through individualized profiles about every aspect of your life. I've suggested now for over a year, I've worked with Mr. Feist, that really the focus of a comprehensive privacy legislation should be less methodologically specific or technologically specific, but rather outlining the universal principles by which we allow the state to aggregate these sorts of data points, because inevitably they're going to multiply with the technologies that come forth. That's what I'd like to see from the ACLU. There, just to a couple of points that have already been made. There is, I think, the 11th Circuit, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's the Florida, Georgia, Alabama Circuit ruled, as it relates to cell phone location data, that, in fact, that does require a search warrant. Partially because of what you pointed out in the sheer volume of data that's available, and kind of alluding to the fact that the resources of it, for example, you don't need a warrant for an officer to track an individual in public places where you have no expectation of privacy. But yet the court ruled in that instance that because of the unique capabilities of cell phones, that in fact you do need a warrant. So there is, the courts are trying to work around that question. It's a difficult one, and it's one that becomes increasingly difficult when we try to parse out, as we're trying to do here, you know, the differences between, well, a drone can do this and a plane can do that. And I think what I'm concerned about is just, like I said at the outset of my point, is that individualized profile that is being put together. And that's where I think the real world ramifications come into play for everyday citizens. So that's my two cents, and I'd like to see the ACLU again focus more on that sort of universal concept rather than trying to get into the address things as they come up and with a sort of triaged approach. So,
thank you, Senator Peterson. Any other questions for Mr. Stanley? Seeing none, then,
Mr. Chair,
thank you very much, Mr. Stanley, for coming such a long way.
Thank you very much.
All right, we're now going to welcome to the table Deputy Commissioner Mark Donaski from the Department of Public Safety, and it looks like at the same time,
they're going to be efficient.
Jim Franklin from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
10 minutes, please.
Mr. Chair, I'll be far short than that. Mark Danaski, representing the Department of Public Safety. I've been asked to come and testify on behalf of the department as to our use of unmanned aerial vehicles. And it's very brief. The Department of Public Safety and its enforcement divisions do not own or operate any UASs. And at this time, we have no plans for owning or operating any UASs. However, based on the testimony today, the department does certainly see that there are certain public safety applications that may come to light. And I know that Mr. Franklin is going to discuss some of those. And so as this discussion goes on in the future, the department hopes to be involved in that and participate in whatever process comes out for the effective and legal use of those types of systems in the state of Minnesota. And with that, I'll defer to Mr. Franklin.
Thank you. Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, Executive Director, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, kind of speaking on behalf of some of the law enforcement people and concerns here today. I came yesterday from the Sheriff's Association meeting where we discussed this particular idea and issue. We came up with a totally different name. We do not like to refer to it as a drone. We refer to it as an aerial photography device. It's the closest we could come to anything that would end in APD, PD meaning police department, so that's the best that we could do as an acronym. We do not own, no law enforcement agencies in Minnesota own any aerial type devices, but I will speak about other photographic types of devices that we do use. I appreciate Mr. Stanley's discussion. Contrary to what he may think about, and we do have several areas of disagreement, and I'll try to highlight several areas where we do agree. It's not the FAA rules that have held us back on getting into this. It's money. It's personnel. It's technology things we just simply don't have. We're still trying to get computers in all of our squad cars in the state of Minnesota. We're trying to get dash cams in all of the squad cars in the state of Minnesota. We're not even there yet. So getting into this technology, we've got a long, long way to go. We do see it as a growing technology. We do see it as something that has some visible and good purposes. We do expect that there will be some law enforcement agencies that will experiment with it or might want to experiment with it. So we think that there's some things there that are very interesting that we would like to maybe take a look at. We've kind of divided this into three categories. One has to do with the investigative type category where you're going to use whatever you have acquired in some type of a criminal or some type of a law enforcement case. The second is in some sort of an emergency or time-sensitive kind of category. And the third is a category called routine or discretion, if you will. Let me just highlight very quickly. We do agree with all of the advocacy issues with regards to the use of search warrants. We think it's absolutely necessary. If you're going to obtain evidence to use it in a court case of some sort, you need to have a search warrant for authorization to do whatever it is you're going to do. The court will exclude that evidence if it's not done properly. The question by Representative Moline focused on flyovers in a wide geographic area versus focused areas. And again, many of those flyovers looking for marijuana are just that. They fly over, that's not focused. Other areas, again, that was thermal imaging, had the court already said that requires a search warrant. So we definitely do think that that's something that needs to be done. We want to comply with the law and do that correctly. We are faced with a number of emergency time-sensitive kinds of situations that we're forced to act very, very quickly on. All of these examples that I'll give you are real-life situations that have occurred. All kinds of missing persons, lost persons, all kinds of things with children, people with dementia, hunters that are lost, suicidal people that have been lost. Let me also cover one other anomaly that occurs here in Minnesota every year. We call it soft ice. People get trapped on our lakes. They get trapped on islands. We have to go rescue them. That's part of our duties as sheriffs in this state. How do we deal with soft ice? We've had cases where we've tried to get life preservers to people on soft ice that have been a half a mile out. Could we someday have a drone that could drop a life preserver, a raft? These are things that, you know, again, technology, we're not there yet, but there are possibilities. I don't know how many of you have ever searched for a suspect in a woods or in a cornfield of 150 acres with an armed gun going row by row. Let me tell you, I would have begged to have a helicopter above. Those are kinds of things that we think are very important that we would like to have. Again, tracking chemical spills in our rivers Those are some of the things that we get involved in. Again, could aerial photography be used in some of those kinds of things? We think that there is uses for this kind of technology. Again, reconstructing accidents, all kinds of things like that. It becomes imperative sometime to preserve that evidence that might be there, responding to all kinds of floods, disasters, man-made disasters. We get into areas and categories with regards to what's routine, what is discretionary. And some of those were already mentioned about crowd control, routine patrol, what do you do with high crime rates. There's a lot of discussion about those kinds of things, and we certainly do need a policy. Let me just highlight very quickly what we're currently using camera-type equipment for. We already have robots. We have other kinds of things for bomb disposal units. We have various technological equipment that some of our SWAT teams use. We've put cameras on canine equipment to try to seek out and find certain things. Heat-seeking devices that are currently used by both fire and police. Underwater cameras that are used for body search recovers. And again, we do use satellite imagery that comes in mapping kinds of things, again, trying to search out kinds of things. Again, if we're going to be doing that in a tactical operation, a search warrant should be necessary. We would apply for those. We really think we're interested in working together as coming up with good policies. We think that we have to have a balanced approach on this to protect the public interest and privacy rights and balance that against our public safety needs. We also think that it's impossible to cover every situation that we encounter in law enforcement, and we'd like to have some type of totality of circumstances and reasonableness in trying to make some of these fast-moving decisions as opposed to a 2020 look back after the incident has occurred. So we definitely would like to work on this. We think it's a challenging area, and we see it as an area that we definitely want to work together to protect the privacy issues as well as develop good public safety practices.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Franklin. Just to point out, it's brought up most of the time when you come and testify, when most people come and testify, there's not a single member that I've ever heard that is opposed to the use of surveillance technology in those exigent circumstances that you pointed out, be it a young child, a violent felon on the loose, anything like that. I've never heard that argument be made in the legislature. One of the questions that I have, and I take it at face value that you guys have not implemented any use of UAVs to this point, is would you encourage your members, when they do start to use this technology, to disclose that to the appropriate policymaking authorities, and not only disclose that they're being used, but also the capabilities that are being used therein? There's obviously been some problems with getting information from state authorities, law enforcement authorities, regarding the use of other surveillance equipment, not only the use of such equipment, but the specifics around that equipment. And so that we're not having a conversation after the fact, but rather we are, like you said, working together to craft an appropriate policy.
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, we'll certainly convey that. And we would support doing that. Again, we've already had some discussions with our county attorneys on specific issues like this. We've had some generalized discussion. I think we're all in agreement with the county attorneys that we want to use search warrants, court orders, those kinds of things in order to properly gain evidence if that's what we're dealing with. So we've had and started some of those discussions.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Franklin, over the years, I've looked more at people's actions versus their words. And I think that you can make a pretty strong correlation that the license plate reader technology is a rudimentary drone, if you will, and that it captures a variety of images, stored. You know, and I hear the discussion at the table about, you know, the accountability for use. But at every turn in trying to tender an agreement over license plate readers, law enforcement has resisted any type of accountability about where they're placed, how they're used. So when I hear your testimony today, I frankly am quite skeptical about whether you really have an understanding of where privacy experts and people with concerns on that side of the ledger are coming from, and that any time that we've tried to build in some of that, maybe even accountability after the fact, we come up against resistance. And if you look at the layering of these technologies where you could have ongoing LPR data feeding in a nearly real time, and then the ability to deploy some type of, you know, you don't like drones, you had a different word, but a surveillance technology able to be deployed at a moment's notice and operated in a tracking type of way, at every single layer of additional technology, the law-abiding citizens' general ability to feel like there's a balanced approach, in other words, that who's watching law enforcement, how do we know that law enforcement is only using this appropriately, is diminished, because at every turn, it appears, at least to me, that law enforcement resists this accountability piece. And so, I mean, I don't know. I guess there's probably not a question there, and I'm, you know, I'm leaving, but the people at this table that are going to struggle with this, there has to be that accountability use piece, and whether it's after the fact or before the fact, that's going to be up to others to decide. But historically in the state of Minnesota for more than 12 years, every time that we've tried to put some kind of accountability factor that would allow sunshine into the operational standards and procedures, we're met with great resistance. And there has to be a line or a balance. We do not want to impede your ability to get the bad guys, but quite frankly, there are some bad guys within your ranks. And we, as the public, have to be able to have enough information so that we can identify those issues as well. And I'm very concerned at the testimony that was presented today that, again, we don't seem to have that balance.
Mr. Chairman.
Response, Mr. Franklin?
Well, I would like to just respond this way. Number one, I feel sorry that we have not been more forthright with you and that you feel the way you feel. We and I personally have done all that I can to try to make this very straightforward, answer the questions correctly, and give you what is the truth. I will tell you that out of 10,000-plus cops, do we have a few that might break the rules? Unfortunately, we probably do. And we work diligently to correct that. And I can just tell you that the current sheriffs and chiefs are dedicated to solving some of these problems and moving this forward. We did bring proposals forward with regards to LPR last year. Last year, we were very close to coming to a compromise and agreement. And it has primarily to do with how long to hold the data, which strictly is whether or not we're going to solve a crime after a point when that data is lost. We had suggested 180 days. We tried to agree to a 90-day. And so we've had this discussion. But we will continue to have this discussion and continue to be at the table and continue to work hard to try to gain your confidence.
I'm certainly concerned about those with ill intent, but I'm even more concerned about those with good intent who may move the balance here between privacy and public safety in a direction that the society may not be so comfortable with. And I think that's probably the bigger struggle for us is where do we find that balance And hopefully we can find some consensus on where to find that balance, too. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Franklin, maybe, I mean, you had mentioned the way that the flyover sort of work is you're not necessarily targeting a specific land or a specific property owner, but you're, you know, flying over to see if somebody is, for example, growing marijuana, which I think is, you know, part of the concern is sort of just gathering mass information to see if there's criminal activity rather than going to a specified property owner or location to get that sort of activity. And I know that the Department of Natural Resources also does lots of flyovers to see if people are deer baiting, for example. So, you know, I think my concern is, should every hunter out there just expect that a drone is flying over their head taking pictures to make sure that they're following all the rules when it comes to our game and fish laws, for example? I think that if we go to them using drones, it certainly would be a lot easier for them to gather information on everyone that's out there hunting and fishing. And do we have a reasonable expectation of privacy on your own land when you're hunting or fishing? You know, that's a different topic. But I guess my question would be then, you know, you sort of mentioned that you would prefer to seek a warrant when, you know, when you are having to do so. So if you go to a drone-based system, is it going to be the approach that you take now where you're just gathering mass aerial images and not targeting a specific property owner, or is it going to be more specific to a property owner, and then would you seek a warrant under those circumstances?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Moline, number one, the DNR flyover looking for bait locations and so on and so forth is what I would classify in my third category called routine operations. You know, I think that has a number of discussions that we have to have about that and how routine patrol operations would be utilized. I think there's tons of questions there, and we're happy to sit down and have those kinds of questions. Specifically to your question about focus, when we focus on a criminal activity, a subject or a suspect for a behavior, it has to be a crime. We have to have evidence that supports a warrant, or we cannot go fly. It's that simple. And I think if we follow the current logic that we have, which is must be a criminal activity, must have evidence to support that, must go get that search warrant or court order to do whatever it is that you want done, if we follow that, we are consistent with current statute, current law. In that case, it would have to be, if you're going to do it, you'd have to have articulable suspicion to get the warrant. Otherwise, it can't be done. The routine flyover is another question. What happens if you are flying, or what happens with an officer, to give you a real-life example, where a man is chasing a woman down the gravel road and into the ditch and clubs her with a baseball bat when you're that far away and you see that? You instantly have to take action because now you have a life safety issue. You've got a crime. What happens if you had been on routine patrol with an aerial device, photographic device, and you saw that? Obviously, dispatch units quickly to that particular thing. So, again, there has to be some balance here. But to your specific question, we feel if you're gathering evidence, you need a warrant.
Senator Hall.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, before Representative Lush had a question.
Sure.
Thank you. Either for Commissioner Danansky or Mr. Franklin, we're going to hear next from the U of M and other government agencies about how they use drones. What is your current procedure? If you want information from them, just doing a flyover because you suspect something, is it put through the same standards that you currently just stated as if you did the work yourself? And what kind of processes or hoops do you have to jump through in order to collect and aggregate data from other government agencies?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Frank.
Representative Lesh. In the cases that I've worked on, we have not contracted with third parties. We have not gone to the university or anybody else for that type of thing. What we have done is taken aerial maps that have been put together by MnDOT or one of the county engineers or something of this nature and use that as a layout relative primarily to, let me just use a tactical case where you're going to do some sort of a tactical operation. We've used that information from our GIS or our county people, just say, give me a plat section such and such an overview of that so we can do some planning and strategy as to placements of vehicles and that sort of thing. We have used this type of information on disaster emergency response. If you recall, I was involved for a number of years with the emergency services here at the state of Minnesota. We would use DNR and other mappings relative to disaster operations, PCA and other kinds of stream information, looking for hazardous materials going down rivers. We would basically request those documents. They were normally paper maps and just use those for planning purposes. I've not used any type of a tactical operation or anything has gone hand in glove with some sort of a search operation, again, back to the warrant issue. But this would be just information that's gathered for tactical planning purposes only.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lush.
And Mr. Franklin, thank you for that. So my understanding is that neither DPS or any sheriffs have ever done this. But what if you did? If you did decide to use it and you said, hey, I know U of M Agriculture Department has this stuff, or a little bird told me, I want to get my hands on it. Do you have a policy or a procedure in place to govern the request and usage of that data? Either the Sheriff's Association or
Mr. Chairman, let me try to answer that question this way. Do we have a policy on that right now? I would dare say probably not. Do we have court decisions that would halt or not allow us to do that? The answer is yes. I can't use a third party to go conduct a search or do something that I would have to get a search warrant for. So if we were going to use their flyover or some other kind of thing, we would really need a search warrant to authorize them to do it for us or something of that nature. Otherwise, whatever is gained from that is going to simply be excluded from the case.
Well, I would sort of dispute that a little bit, Mr. Franklin, but I understand your position, so thank you for the answer.
Well, just as a follow-up to that, Mr. Franklin, what about seeking data that they already have that might cover something that you're looking for or that you suspect might have some information you find useful?
Mr. Chairman, I would refer that back to the agency and the classification of the data based on the Minnesota Data Practices Law. What is the classification of the data, and can I get the data? If I cannot get the data as public data or something like that, then I have to go through the search warrant. If it's classified as public data, why can I not get it as a member of the public?
Mr. Chair, I would concur with that. And I don't have a specific instance, but if there's information out there, whether it's imagery or something else that's gathered by another governmental agency that's public data, such as historical imagery of whatever it might be, and it's in an archive someplace that's readily accessible to the public, as I said, I don't have a specific incidence of this, but I would assume that based on the data practices, we would have access to that, and we might actually look at that.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
My question's been answered. Thank you.
Any other questions for these testifiers? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, Commissioner, I would like to call you Colonel still. Commissioner Dansky, what's the regulation on these traffic cameras? Now, how do you handle that? You add it up there and you're turning around to see if it's snowing or getting icy and you see something going on. I imagine that's going to be similar to your laws on your drones. Can you send somebody out? I would imagine if it's ongoing crime or something needs to be investigated.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I represent the Department of Public Safety, not the DOT, of course. But as you're well aware, the Department of Transportation does operate cameras on the interstates and on other areas throughout the state of Minnesota that are accessed through our Traffic Management Center in Roseville and in Rochester and in Duluth. And if there is an incident that's seen on or viewed on those cameras, we indeed do dispatch public safety or law enforcement officers to those incidents.
All right. Thank you both for your testimony. Dr. McCray and Demos Exibir, please correct me if I mispronounced anything. Welcome to the Senate, to the joint committees hearing. Go ahead and state your full names before you testify. Please make sure you sign in before you leave the table. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Ian McCray. I'm a professor with the Department of Entomology, the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. As I had said, I'm an entomologist. I work with, I'm charged with finding environmentally and economically sustainable methods of controlling insect pests in agricultural systems. I've been working with remote sensing, for a number of years, and we look at unmanned aerial systems. We usually call them UAS because in entomology, a drone is a male bee, and it could lead to confusion. So we use UAS as a platform to mount a number of different remote sensors, which can basically assess plant health and give us an indication of what kind of insect stress or disease stress that we're seeing. It's an intermediate platform. I mean, we've been doing this for a number of years on ground-based, using satellites and using aerial imagery. UAS allows us to look at, although it's a smaller footprint, it allows us to get better resolution and it allows us to facilitate a lot of research. In addition, these systems allow us to gather imagery with geographic coordinates, so we know the location of all the points of each image, and that facilitates the adoption of precision agriculture, which is the concept of using agricultural inputs not only across an entire field, but only where you need them. If we look at the increasing population level and consider the need to increase food, also look at the amount of arable land that's going to be available over the next few years, we're going to have to increase food production through efficiency, not through an increase in acreage. And so Precision Ag is one of the large players in increasing that efficiency. The College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences has a number of research programs in which they are using UAS at the moment. I know that soil, climate, and water are using it to look at nutrient needs. Of course, there's my program in entomology. Plant pathology is using it. There's a number of different projects, and they're looking at different aspects. The data, it was an interesting question when you had discussed data. Any data that's collected by the University of Minnesota that can be attributable to an identifiable individual has to be reviewed and okayed by our approved by our institutional review board, and they're charged with reviewing research projects that involve human subjects to uphold two broad standards. First, that subjects are not placed at undue risk, and second, that they give uncoerced, informed consent to their participation. This actually even refers to surveys. If we have something in the survey that can be traced to an identifiable individual, we have to place that survey through IRB review before we're allowed to institute it. The entomology program that I'm involved in is probably a fairly good example of the kind of work that's going on. We currently are gathering information on research and outreach centers. So most of our work, in fact, all of our work to date, has been done on university property. We have received certificates of authorization from the FAA to fly these UAS for research purposes on 7 of the ROC and research facilities across the state. Our pilot for my program is actually a certified pilot. He's working on his CFI, as a matter of fact. So we take great care to stay within FAA compliance for our work. The work that we do is rather broad. I've done a lot of entomological work. We work currently on projects that do things like evaluating defoliation by Colorado potato beetle, which is a particularly devastating insect in the potato industry. We work with soybean aphid, which is probably the most important insect pest of soybean, which is one of the two top crops in the state by acreage. So we have a min drive. We are cooperating on a min drive that actually looks at potential for precision ag to manage soybean aphid using UAS and remote sensing. We've also looked at disease. We have successfully used this technology to look at bacterial wheat streak in wheat. So there's a number of projects going on. Most of these are collaborative efforts. The UAS industry is projected to be between $80 and $85 billion industry. Most of that will probably be in agriculture, or a large part of it. It's going to probably be a fairly significant game changer in the way that we produce crops in the next several generations. So it's very exciting to be involved in this. And although it's interesting to hear some of the other applications, it's important to realize these are more than just surveillance. There's a lot of applications to this that are going to be quite beneficial to, in our area, certainly in agriculture. So.
Thank you, Dr. McCray. Right, sir.
And I'm Demos Gebrek-Zeb here. I'm a professor in the Aerospace Engineering and Mechanics Department here at the University of Minnesota, and I'm one of two faculty members that directs the University of Minnesota UAV Laboratory. Our work, I guess we have two missions really in the lab. It's to do both educational and research missions related with the UAS. On the education side, what we use UASs for, and we've been using them for quite a while, is as training tools for training engineers. So in our aerospace engineering curriculum, for example, one of the last thing that students have to do is design a flying vehicle, and part of that is to part of the testing we do with that class is we have students actually build them and fly these UASs for educational purposes. So that's one of the things we do. On the research side of the house, most of our work deals with using UAS as surrogates for actually larger aircraft. And so we use them to test out new and innovative ideas for navigation, guidance, and control of larger aircraft in these small vehicles, whereby if something does go wrong, they don't... The ideas we have are not quite mature. We are not losing an airplane or an airplane with a pilot on it. It's just a small UAS that's sacrificed. So we use it for developing advanced navigation and guidance concepts. So, for example, we've got several projects going on. One of them we have right now is we are contracted by NASA to develop technologies for the next generation of commercial aircraft that are supposed to be very fuel efficient. And the way one of the ways we're going to be doing that is building aircraft that are very flexible, that can morph, basically look like birds or insects. And we really don't know how to do the control of those kind of vehicles right now. And so what we do is we use UASs that are flexible, that are really strange and unusual, to test out these concepts. So we use them as surrogates for testing out new and advanced ideas. And another thing we do a lot of in our lab these days is to look at the safety, reliability, and certification issues associated with the UASs. So a lot of the research we're doing is trying to understand how to make these vehicles safe, reliable, and cost-effective at the same time. So we have both an educational and a research mission. And the data we collect on these things really, for the most part, is, in our case, we have small, something that's equivalent to a black box on a real airplane. And what we do is collect data on the aircraft speed, orientation, what it was doing, so that after the fact we can process the data and understand what our designs were all about and things like that. So... Again, most of the work we do is using these aircraft as surrogates for testing out advanced navigation guidance and concepts for aircraft. And we do collaborate with, in the case with Professor McRae, the project where we're looking at agriculture, we are building the platforms that are going to be used for doing some of the work that he and his lab is doing.
So some of the most cutting-edge innovations in the design of UASs may come out of your lab as well? Or is that happening, do you believe, more on the commercial side of development of these products?
Chairman, so yes, some of the work, particularly when it comes to safety and reliability of these vehicles, yes, I think some of that work is going to come out of our group because that's one of the big focus of our work is how do you make these inexpensive aerospace vehicles reliable and safe at the same time.
Thank you. Have you been doing any collaboration or been approached by industry in any way to do research on their behalf in the development of next generation, if you will, of UASs?
Chairman, yes. And we do continue to work with different companies, big and small, to look at new ideas and concepts. So, again, I just gave an example of this project. NASA's contracted us to help them figure out how to do this. And once we've done with this, they're going to take our ideas and actually flight test them out on their own airplanes. But we've worked with local industry. Lockheed Martin, when it was here in town, we worked with them. We've worked with Honeywell. We've worked with other companies as well on ideas and concepts related to small UAS.
Are there other departments at the university that you've been collaborating with besides the Dr. McRae's group?
Chairman, yes. I mean, I'm just using the Aerospace Engineering Department as an example, but there is a group in the Computer Science Department and Electrical Engineering that are doing work that's similar, and we collaborate with them closely. And I may add, all the flying we do is at a COA that's authorized and approved by the FAA. So we, very much like Professor McRae's lab, we have a pretty strict procedure for how we operate and how we fly these vehicles. And it's all blessed, it's all under a COA.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, sir, what? Give me an idea of the people that are operating these. What's their average, like, age and background training? How much training do they get to operate these things? And how many of them do you have actual devices, these whirlybirds?
Chairman, is that question for me or for Dr. McRae? We're two separate labs. But I could talk about our lab.
Directing the question to Representative Cornish?
Yes, sir, the actual operator of the device. And how many devices are in the actual background? How much training they've had to operate them?
Chairman.
Mr. Exibir. Did I say it right?
Close.
Close?
Okay.
Good enough.
Sorry. So our lab is the lab is directed. We have two lab directors, which are ex-NASA engineers, and both of them are pilots. So when it comes to flying the airplanes, it's under their guidance and their tutelage that happens. Even students that build airplanes and flying, they're not flying them. They build the design them, and then there's an actual pilot that does the flying. So we have controls in place where only people that we believe are qualified and safe to operate these aircraft.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, actually one of the codicils of most of our COAs is that the operator has to be a pilot. Oftentimes, we're operating in areas that have our certificates of authorization have what are called exclusions because we are operating within 3 miles of an airstrip or something of that nature. And consequently, the FAA requires us to actually use a licensed pilot as the UAS operator.
Any other questions? Representative Lush.
Thank you for either of the professors. Do you have a policy for dealing with data that you collect for academic purposes that may implicate privacy interests of individual Minnesotans for which you use it? And if there is such a policy, I mean, how do you deal with that in terms of this data, which ultimately may become public?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leish, we don't, well, I don't believe we have a solid policy. That would be a better question for our OGC or Office of General Counsel rather than for myself. But to date, the data have all been gathered from University of Minnesota facilities, so it actually is on public, you know, on state property. Generally speaking, that would make that data public data.
And
Representative Lush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that answer, Professor McRae. But, you know, with respect to, let's say, police officers using it too, I mean, their intent is to get the suspect. But in the course of that, sometimes other data is collected. For example, private land abuts University of Minnesota land, I'm sure. And so I'm just wondering about the eventuality. You may be correct that there's nothing that would need to be looked at, but I was just wondering about if there was a policy for that eventuality, considering the imminent proliferation of this technology. So, but I think you gave your answer, so thank you.
So we should check in with the University of Minnesota Office of General Counsel to get some input from them at some point as well. Any other questions for these testifiers? Thank you, gentlemen, both of you. Justin Lutterman, GIS manager from Le Sueur County. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Committees. Good afternoon. My name is Justin Lutterman. I'm the GIS manager for Le Sueur County. And our county is in possession of one of the nation's first and largest COAs to fly UAV, a public aircraft that is commissioned by a commercially contracted provider. Our endeavor started about 2 years ago, and we went through the process to get approved by the FAA and jumped through the necessary hoops that we had to go through in order to be approved. And this was all commissioned under our county board and overseen by them as well as our county attorney. The approval came in August of this year, and we began testing over our area. The way that the way that our air space is all of Le Sueur County is available except for urban areas over certain cities, and the two airports, the Mankato Airport and Le Sueur Airport, we have to operate within 2 miles of those particular areas. The reason why they had granted us such a large area, which was unexpected, was because of our agriculture ditching systems, which is what primarily we were going to use it for. The nature of these ditches is that they're pretty rural and takes quite a bit of time to inspect them, and oftentimes they don't get done. And we thought that this would be a great application for a UAV. During our testing, however, to my surprise, we found many more uses for this technology. Photography, of course, being one of those, current photography. But the nature of the UAV as it takes pictures, overlapping images, is able to create 3D elevation models, which is very helpful in many applications, surveying, road construction, identifying a watershed boundary, or various other applications, anytime you need to know the height of something. And since I'm able to drop this, it's geo-registered, as the gentleman before me were testifying, it then becomes data, which is then usable in engineering programs and as well as GIS programs. To give you an example, for a typical road project where one would do a cross-section to get the elevation for this particular road, normally what the engineer will do is have a couple surveyors go out and identify the center line of the road, as well as every 100 feet get a shot of the bituminous pavement, the ditches, the bottom of the ditch, the top of the ditch, and anything else that is important on that particular road, whether it's a tree, a mailbox, or a home. And that would take normally about a week for just one linear mile of road to do something like that if it was a simple road. With a UAV, we would be able to do that within 10 to 15 minutes. And be able to process it and have all the information. It would be substantially better than the information that we would use normally, and it would be 16 to 20 times cheaper for the taxpayer. I welcome any questions.
Representative Blush.
Thank you, Mr. Letterman, and I may have missed this in your testimony, but did you coordinate and check into all the FFA requirements, FFA and FAA requirements before you did this?
More during. I'm sorry. We went through the FAA. I commissioned our contractor that we were dealing with, Tim Briggs from Aerologix, to do the coordinating with the FAA.
Okay. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about your – I'm sorry, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a simple question, and I apologize if I missed it. Does the county own and operate their own vehicle, or are you contracting with the feds or a private company?
Mr. Chair, Senator, to answer your question, we lease the aircraft. That is what is required by the FAA in order to fly this. We own the aircraft essentially, and it is dispatched by myself and the county board. So we do own it, but we have not purchased it per se, but it is ours in lease under the FAA.
Senator Nino.
Who's operating it, literally flying it?
It is operated by our contractor, who is certified by the FAA licensed pilot and obtained the COA for the county.
Sorry if I wasn't clear about that earlier.
Mr. Litterman, is that contractor Aerologix?
That contractor is Aerologix, correct.
So they're a private company, right?
They are a private company, yes.
Okay, and so you've worked with them to develop this, but and we actually asked Mr. Briggs from Aerologix to be able to testify today as well, and he's out of the state, so he was unable to join us. But can you tell us a little bit about your work with their company and kind of what they do?
The company is one man. It's Tim Briggs. And he contacted me because he lives in the county and wanted to see if he could get some program like this off of the ground. The program owns one aircraft, and, well, now LeSueur County owns the aircraft, but he is able to fly that at a certain altitude granted by the FAA, which is 500 feet from any structure and below 600 feet above ground level. If we want to have photography, we, the county, want to have photography, we can commission Mr. Logix from Aerologix, or Tim from Aerologix, to fly our particular area of interest and use it for information. He is under contract with the county, and we are to pay him for his services, which at this point are $500 per square mile.
Thank you, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one other question. Is there anything akin to a flight plan that gets filed? How does that process work? If you say go fly over this acreage, how is that defined? Are there controls? Could you tell me a little bit more about that process?
Mr. Luderman.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the flight plan is available for inspection from the FAA at any time. Mr. Lodges keeps the records and it is available to be audited. His flight plan, I unfortunately won't be able to attest accurately on what he needs to do for that, but I believe he contacts air control, air traffic control, lets them know that we're going to be flying in this area. His specific flight plan, I am not 100% sure about, but he does let the the air traffic control of the area that he is going to be flying in.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for Mr. Woodham? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Mark Anfinson.
Feds are listening in.
That's the surveillance system you hear buzzing above us.
I am an advocate against all forms of privacy, Mr. Chairman, so it doesn't bother me a bit.
We figured that. We figured that.
We know.
We knew that before you got here.
You're just testing me. Mr. Chairman,
we bugged all the materials we used to prepare, so we
You better be careful, Mr. Chairman. I may use my long version of my remarks here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I, Mark Anfinson, I am the attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association, have been so for many years. I also represent many of the individual news organizations in the state over time on issues like you are discussing. I am honored, since Mr. Gemberling just left, to be the last witness, I think, for the hearing. And so I am going to proceed with all due humility, thanking each of you at the same time for eagerly anticipating what I'm going to tell you, which may be an anticlimax at this point.
Maybe I should ask, is Jay Reading in the room?
Yes.
Okay. You're not going to be the last one, Mr. Anfinson.
Oh, well, then I don't have to be humble about this. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I shouldn't have said that.
You should. I, as did the first witness way back hours ago, I also commend the legislature for addressing this issue because, as the testimony has clearly shown and as the literature about this topic of drones demonstrates even more vividly, this is a really complex issue with many excellent uses and many terrible uses that drones offer. And sorting out how to regulate those two features of the drone issue, I think, is a unique legislative function. No other public body can do that as well as a legislative body in terms of the subtle balancing that has to be done. So, again, we commend you for taking this on. My comments here are brief. They focus on the interest of the news media in the drone issue, and that interest is very significant. It's significant due to the fact that there are many potential benefits to news organizations of using drones for news gathering purposes. And here's where I'm not going to be humble. It is also of interest to the news media because the news media can collect a lot of information with drones that doesn't just benefit us. It will be of distinct advantage to the general public that wasn't accessible before. Drones are much less expensive than many other technologies for acquiring difficult video. They're much safer in types of news operations where you're covering dangerous environments, of course. And they can acquire unique views of different events that you'd never get from any other source. So those are the basis for our interest. Around the country, drones have been used already by news organizations many times for both routine and unique news gathering. They've provided video of burning buildings, traffic snarls and problems, explosions, natural disasters, and storms. Some of you may have seen what I think is one of the best recent illustrations of how these drones can function in the news context. When Buffalo got hit by that mega blizzard a few weeks ago, I was watching the evening news, and someone, I don't know if it was the news organization itself or a private freelancer, was able to send a drone down some of Buffalo's residential streets that were completely impassable by any wheel vehicle, just a few feet off the ground. And it was a remarkably vivid portrayal of what they were dealing with in Buffalo. And that was a drone that accomplished that. So
I think that was probably a few feet off the snow.
Yeah.
Maybe about 20
25 feet off the ground. Yeah, that's good clarification, Mr. Chairman. So as with some of the other contexts that you've talked about where drones are used, the punchline of our position is that there are many publicly beneficial purposes to drones. And so that I think that counsels caution and care in crafting legislation to deal with this issue. And in the media context, there's actually a First Amendment issue of some consequence that comes into play. In other words, to what extent can the government restrict news organizations from acquiring news video by regulation with a drone? Hasn't been sorted out at all, but it's certainly going to come up. One other comment I'd make that may be relevant to your deliberations as you go forward is simply this. Keep in mind that there are existing privacy laws in Minnesota that apply to drones now and that could be used to regulate them. In particular, there is a tort recognized by our Supreme Court called intrusion upon seclusion, which allows a private party, to sue someone who intrudes upon their privacy by any method, technological or otherwise. And that law is already on the books and may be part of the solution for your deliberations. So, in conclusion, I wish you the best in addressing this difficult issue, and we are always happy to help and provide input in terms of specific legislative proposals. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Amphinson, are you aware of any news organizations that have or are seeking FAA approval to use UASs?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, there are quite a few that have tried, but I think our first witness today talked about the Perker case, which is this guy who flew a drone over the University of Virginia to capture some video for a commercial purpose, and the FAA sanctioned him, fined him $10,000 for doing that. He then appealed to the National Transportation, to an administrative law judge within the FAA hierarchy, and 12 or 15 major national news organizations jumped on board and filed an amicus submission supporting, on First Amendment grounds, his right to acquire that video and indirectly defending their right to do the same thing. They very much would like to do this, but just in November, as the witness described, the NTRB, which has ultimate jurisdiction here, reversed the administrative law judge and said, nope, we're going back to our old, very restrictive rules. And so the status right now is that it's almost impossible for any news organization to lawfully get one of these COAs to operate a drone for news gathering purposes.
Well, so the FAA has complete discretion on whether to grant such a license, right? And I'm sorry, I missed part of the earlier testimony that went into that, but are there criteria already set out that if you qualify, you'd be entitled to a certificate or authorization?
Mr. Chairman, there are specific criteria set out. I am by no means an expert in them, but they exist, and they're very daunting. Very difficult for any news organization to satisfy, I assure you, because virtually nobody has been able to use drones right now in the country, especially since this NTRB decision in November.
Thank you. Oh. Any questions from members of the committees? Mr. Anfinson. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Testimony. Good to see you.
Mr. Reading. Did I pronounce that correctly?
It's actually Mr. Redding.
Redding, but with one D.
Close.
But one D?
That is correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, my name is Jay Redding. I am an attorney at the firm of Largan Hoffman with a practice in civil litigation. I'm also part of sort of an informal working group with the members of the State Capitol Law Firms group discussing drones and UAS issues. And perhaps more relevant to what this committee will be concerned with, I'm actually also a hobbyist drone pilot, and I've actually built some of these aircraft. And I'm a member of the Academy of Model Aeronautics, which is the interest group that represents the interest group of model pilots and drone enthusiasts nationwide. And the drone technology has the great potential to revolutionize the American economy, create jobs, and save lives. In Texas, there's a group called Texas EquiSearch that has used remotely controlled aircraft to search for and, in some cases, locate missing persons. In Ohio, a group called Flight Test has a very popular YouTube show that encourages citizens, young and old, to explore aviation, build model aircraft, and encourages education in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And we've already heard some testimony about farmers beginning to use these drones to monitor the growth and development of their crops. You can take a small $200 to $300, you know, essentially beer cooler foam aircraft, attach ultraviolet and infrared imaging to it, and be able to look at your field and tell exactly which parts of that field need water, which ones need fertilizer, what needs herbicide, and apply it only to those areas that need it rather than just covering the entire area. But ultimately, this promise is being hampered by two factors. First is that there's a negative public image of drones that I think is only beginning to change. And second is the regulatory environment just hasn't caught up. Now, it's undeniably true that there are safety concerns with the use of these drones, but the FAA's categorical ban on the commercial use of drones at essentially any altitude is, I believe, contrary to common sense and congressional intent under the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2012. A hobbyist using a drone below 400 feet in line of sight is perfectly legally authorized to do that. But if they make so much as $1, then all of a sudden it becomes a safety issue. And that approach seems to me fundamentally unworkable. You know, here in Minnesota, and we've already heard testimony, I believe, from Mr. Chance on this, that there are already several businesses and other organizations are using drones for productive purposes, everything from aerial photography, and we heard about the aeronautical research being conducted by the university. But the lack of regulatory clarity and the FAA's inability to meet congressional deadlines is hurting the ability for these groups to work successfully and safely within the national airspace. Ultimately, what needs to happen is there needs to be a common sense, risk-based approach to this. Common sense in the sense that the skills that a licensed commercial pilot needs are not the same skills that a drone operator needs. In fact, they're quite different. As someone who's done a little bit of training to become a private pilot and also has been flying drones for about 3 years, the skill sets don't always translate. And second of all, there needs to be an approach based on risk. Someone flying a 3-pound aircraft made out of foam at safe altitudes away from people or structures is not going to be a safety risk in the same sense that someone flying a device the size of a 737 interacting with commercial airlines are. And so crafting the right regulatory balance between that interest of safety of the national airspace and that interest of commercial development hasn't happened yet. And that's, I unfortunately, the people from the FAA aren't here, so I can criticize them to their face. But I think the FAA has been stalling on this issue. They're now over a year late in developing rulemaking, and now we're learning that it may not be until 2017 before they do this. And just this week, there was testimony before the United States House of Representatives, the Transportation Subcommittee. And I was quite heartened to see in that testimony that many of the members of Congress seem to understand these issues and were surprisingly clueful about the risks in terms of safety as well as the opportunities. I believe it was Representative Fahrenthold of Texas who was talking. He was going to buy a drone for his kids for Christmas, and he flies one himself at the golf course, and he asked the FAA, well, isn't it more dangerous for someone to be hit by a flying golf ball than one of these drones? And the FAA didn't really have a good answer to that, in my opinion. But that kind of gives the broad outline of where we are in terms of regulation. And what I would, you know, ask this committee to consider is look at a proper balance of the risks involved and the opportunities involved, especially in terms of agriculture. And what Lesueur County is doing is, I think, phenomenal. I think it's a great boon to the taxpayers, and it's advancing the technology and leading the way in many ways. And it's excellent that the state of Minnesota is becoming part of that vanguard in creating new and effective ways of using this technology. But in order to keep that edge, we have to make sure that we don't pass regulations that overly restrict this technology, that properly balance safety and security with the opportunity that this that these drones portend.
So, Mr. Redding, can you give me some idea here? I'm trying to figure out where's the space for legislative action here. You know, clearly the feds, in terms of commercial use, the feds are going to have to figure out their regulatory scheme, when it will be allowed and under what circumstances. But it sounds like from that point of view, we really have nothing that we can do as a practical matter except to sort of anticipate somewhere down the road what kind of parameters we want to put on that if there's room allowed to do that by the feds. That leaves the other areas, however, the hobbyists, that we certainly could take some steps to regulate, restrict, shape, allow. And then also with regard to use by law enforcement or government agencies. So do you agree with that kind of framework, or is there something I'm missing? What do you think?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you essentially answered your own question. I think right now the FAA has placed this categorical ban. They've taken the position, and the FAA representative said this, that anything 10 feet above the ground is subject to FAA regulations. And sort of to illustrate what I think is the absurdity of that, if I were to fold this piece of paper into a paper airplane and fling it across the room, which I certainly will not do, they would say that's an aircraft, it's a contrivance designed to be flown through the air. In theory, the FAA is asserting regulatory authority over that. So you can see the broad, you know, claim of federal authority. On the state level, law enforcement is probably the biggest area where there is an opportunity for some legislative involvement. And I would agree with Mr. Anfinson that the laws we have, you know, a trespass upon land is still a trespass upon land if it's done by a drone. You know, invasion of privacy laws still apply whether it's being done by a webcam or whether it's being done by a drone. And so the risk, I think, that takes with regulation on the state level is, one, the FAA is trying to take over this entire area, and second, drawing those lines in the correct way to balance the need to have some level of privacy, some level of security, and also the opportunities that this have once the FAA steps away.
So we could pass a sense of the legislature that the FAA ought to move more quickly so that we can have more widespread use commercially from the beneficial effects or uses of these devices. But beyond that, not a whole lot we can do in terms of the commercial use. Would you agree with that?
In terms of the commercial use, yes, that is true, Mr. Chairman.
Sounds to me like there's a real economic benefit to be had for expediting the commercial use of these devices in terms of cost savings and efficiencies and other things that we've heard testimony about. All right, thank you. Representative Lush.
Thank you. Mr. Redding, just so I'm clear on the non-commercial applications, you said 400 feet, was it, that I can fly it?
Yes. The Academy of Model Aeronautics, Representative Lash, has guidelines, and they're not binding in any legal sense. But I should mention there was a question about insurance. The AMA also provides its members with additional insurance coverage, so that if you are flying according to AMA rules, and heaven forbid there's an accident, which is very, very rare, I think there's only been a handful of cases over the decades, their insurance would potentially kick in above the homeowner's insurance that may be in place. But yes, the AMA promulgates those rules, and they say you'll fly below 400 feet away from any people, structures, or aircraft.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lush.
Mr. Redding, I guess what I'm more interested in is what are the legally binding rules. So if I go out and buy a drone, are there limitations, and I don't use it to make money, directly, are there limits on how big it can be, how far I can fly it, or anything else other than that? I mean, is there even a 50-foot limit? Can I fly it over my neighbor's pool and let it hover there the entire time he's swimming?
Mr. Redding.
Representative Lash, Mr. Chairman, the FAA the Perker case actually deals with that to some extent. And it is a regulatory gray area. I mean, there are no hard and fast rules. You know, there are technological limits, obviously. But the FAA is taking the position that they can go after anyone, including a hobbyist, who flies what they term in a reckless or dangerous manner. That's how they put the $10,000 fine against Mr. Perker. And that was also a case in New York that settled where someone was flying a small quadcopter above the streets of Manhattan, crashed it. Thankfully, no one was hurt, but I believe they tried to fine him $10,000 as well, and he did settle that case for an undisclosed amount.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from Mr. Redding? Any further comments from members of the committee about this topic? Any final comments, Representative Lush?
Well, Mr. Chair, I look forward to working with you on both sides of the aisle this coming session because I think it's clear that we have our work cut out for us. People have brought up, we've done a lot of work on drones already in the last legislative session, but just sitting here hearing the different experts testify, I've seen some other areas that were not even considered in our previous consideration. So I appreciate the testifiers coming and those of you who sat through this.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodman.
I learned a lot today, a lot of things that kind of make me uncomfortable and realize how much work we do have to do in this area. The one thing I'm thinking, and Senator Limmer and I were discussing briefly, was what are other countries doing and how we have no way of controlling that, what they get, what kind of information they get from their drones or what they're doing with them. So I'm not a great believer in conspiracy theories, but I am increasingly concerned about how far this is going to go.
All right. Senator Nino.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to extend a thank you to the committee to the chairs for holding this hearing, for the committee letting me sit in. I'm not a member of these committees, and I apologize for missing the first parts of the testimony. I had some family stuff I had to deal with. But I think what you heard were a lot of the reasons why I tried to get the conversation going in the last couple of years. This is a very broad issue, some of which we can't deal with. I mean, we can't get the FAA to move, to help us boost our economy with all the economic advantages. But we could take a look at some of the concerns and the things that are out there and get in front of this, both potentially on the private side. There are potential for abuses there, but the larger concern, at least in my mind, is in the public side, you know, with governmental agencies and law enforcement, and making sure that from both perspectives, the perspective of protecting citizens and rights and privacy, that we do a good job, but also from the perspective of public safety, because you've heard the testimony, there are tremendous upsides to this kind of technology. Lives can be saved. Money can be saved in the process of saving lives. And hopefully we can get our arms wrapped around this, at least in a large part, and get a good product done.
All right. Any final thoughts? Members of the committees and of the audience and the testifiers, thank you so much for all of your time and input. The committees are adjourned.
Take care. Have a good Christmas and everything.
You too.
Yeah. See you soon.
Yep. It's
okay. Send hi.
Yeah.
Talking about that. Yeah, that's been a.
So, thank you for finally being able to pull my question right here at the end. What can you really do? It doesn't sound like you made it sound like you can do more than you make it sound like almost.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of it that may be hard to do.
Hi there.
So they think, oh, they assume
yes, yes.
How's your?
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Oh, what you're shaping up.
This is kind of a
pretty good response. I had a really good response. Other authorities
have been saying hang on. You guys don't.
So Monday I'm going to go see the granddaughter.